Monday, November 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. presidential election is now just a day away with growing concerns of potential violence. The aftermath of Friday's deadly earthquake in Turkey and a nearby Greek island. Also ahead, the U.K. goes on lockdown as COVID-19 bears down. It's all on today's International Edition. Election Day is now just a day away as the presidential candidates are no longer looking to reshape the race, instead focusing on the base. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Does anybody have a coat I could use, please?
President Trump began his final push in Washington, Michigan, at an outdoor rally with whipping winds and temperatures that felt well below freezing. With 91 million Americans already having voted, the candidates are focused on making sure any potential supporters do cast ballots.
You better get out there and vote.
The president was also holding rallies in North Carolina, Iowa, Georgia, and Florida Sunday. Joe Biden is focusing on Pennsylvania, while running mate Kamala Harris also headed to North Carolina and Georgia, looking to flip them.
Until every person has been heard and has heard what we have to say, I think our job is a job that is ongoing.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
As Americans participate in the 2020 elections during a pandemic, the Atlanta, Georgia-based Carter Center, founded by former President Jimmy Carter, is working to educate U.S. voters. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports.
Launched in 1986 by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, the Carter Center has long promoted peace and democracy around the globe. As part of that mission, the Carter Center became a leading election monitoring organization, observing more than 110 contests in Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
We've always worked for peace around the world, but we've kind of ignored the United States.
Among the reasons, judging the fairness of elections is a monumental task in a nation like the United States, where all 50 states have differing laws and rules for voting and counting ballots.
The Constitution basically says that each state is independent, and that's one of the reasons why we have such a diverse way of conducting elections.
But after U.S. intelligence agencies documented foreign interference in the 2016 U.S. election and predicted a repeat in 2020, the Carter Center concluded their international experience might help at home by focusing on voter education.
You know, when people understand how the election process works, it helps them to set their own expectations about the process. And with that, you can sort of build confidence in the overall administration of the election process. So,
Amory Davis Roberts is an associate director in the Carter Center's Democracy Program.
You're going to want to buckle up for this one.
Which has been working to educate Americans about casting absentee and mail-in ballots, a record number of which were requested this year because of the coronavirus pandemic.
This is an unusual election for the United States. You know, we haven't, in my lived experience, been through an election like this before. So, you know, I think we're all sort of learning as we go.
The Carter Center recently joined the Georgia Bipartisan Task Force on Safe, Secure, and Accessible Elections, and is offering expertise and guidance to officials in the state, where voters are not only casting ballots for president, but also two U.S. senators.
Your vote, your voice is important.
The center is also offering training for journalists on international election standards and transparency, and hosting virtual conferences about voting. But Davis Roberts emphasizes the Carter Center is not officially observing the 2020 U.S. election.
We're not going to be making an overall statement on the degree to which the entire electoral process met international standards as we might in other countries where we are able to deploy a sort of a large-scale systematic observation mission.
Even so, the Carter Center aims to promote transparency and patience.
We want all of the votes to be counted. We want to know that every voice is heard, and so we have to be patient and we have to sort of allow that process to unfold.
Former President Carter's hopes for America extend far beyond boosting voter participation and confidence in elections.
Not only in peace, but also human rights and environmental equality and the treatment of everybody as equals, no matter, you know, what their religion might be or no matter what party they might be.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Over 60 million people have already cast their ballots in the U.S., and one group seeing more access to the vote than before are people who were formerly incarcerated. In some U.S. states, people with felony convictions may be barred from voting even after they have served their sentences. Reuters reports that the Sentencing Project, which advocates for criminal justice reform, says felony convictions will disenfranchise about 5.2 million Americans this year, but that number is down 15% from 2016. The group says this year's presidential election is the first since 1976 in which the number of Americans unable to vote because of a felony conviction has declined. For more on voting for formerly incarcerated people and how it might impact the election, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins about what's going on with the voting rights of ex-felons and in particular in the state of Florida.
Well, Florida is trying to get former criminal felons off the voting rolls as early voting is already underway in the state and millions of people have already voted in early voting. But it comes as the Supreme Court back in July basically ruled that Florida can bar people with felony convictions from voting unless they have paid fees, fines, and other restitution. And it comes as an attempt to water down a 2018 law on felon voting rights that ended this lifetime voting ban for most felons. Until then, they were not allowed to vote at all. But the legislature, a year later, limited that right to people who have paid court order fines or fees. Now, a University of Florida study estimates some 775,000 felons in the state have these court debts and would not be eligible to vote. And the state says about 85,000 voters on Florida's voting rolls could be ineligible to vote. And this is in another key battleground state that President Trump won by less than 113,000 votes in 2016. So not allowing ex-felons to vote may favor President Trump and the Republican Party in the state.
And what's the reasoning for these requirements that people pay those fees and restitutions before they're allowed to vote?
They say that this is the only way for these ex-felons to actually achieve full restitution if they pay these fines. And they also fear that a lot of ineligible people will try to vote. Now, civil rights groups had sued basically saying that this is in violation of equal protection principles of the 24th Amendment, which bars poll tax. And these ex-felons would have to pay in some cases $1,000 or more to wipe out their debt, which would allow them to register to vote. And these civil rights groups are basically saying these are poor people. They don't have that money. And you're basically asking them to pay money to vote.
You mentioned that not allowing ex-felons to vote may favor President Trump and the Republican Party. Why is that?
A majority of these ex-felons are minorities, a lot of African-American men, and those men tend to vote for the Democrats. Political analysts say this would clearly help the president because it would disenfranchise people who may otherwise be voting for the Democrat and former Vice President Joe Biden.
Now, there are also efforts by some Democrats to help ex-felons pay off these debts. What's been going on with those efforts?
Well, they're pretty big efforts, and there clearly is a lot of outrage around the country for what's going on down in Florida by preventing these ex-felons with court debt from being able to vote. And last month, former Democratic presidential candidate and billionaire Michael Bloomberg helped to raise $16 million to pay for these felons' debts and allow them to register to vote. And basically, there were more than 44,000 individuals and other entities that joined Bloomberg on this donor list to pay off some of these felons' court debt again, allowing them to vote. The Florida Restoration Coalition estimates that Bloomberg and others' efforts have paid court debts for about 32,000 felons, restoring their voting rights to right what they call a very sad situation of disenfranchising people's voting rights in Florida.
VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. The UN Human Rights Office warns Myanmar's discriminatory citizenship and electoral laws cast doubt on the fairness of next week's general elections, putting the country's professed transition to democracy at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights says new rules and regulations put in place ahead of Myanmar's November 8th general elections create further restrictions on people's right to participate in this political process. Those most affected are the Rohingya Muslim and ethnic Rakhine population in Rakhine State. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA decisions announced in mid-October by the UN Election Commission have significantly disenfranchised these minority groups.
So even where they would have otherwise been able to vote, elections aren't taking place in many of these townships. So as I said, elections will not be taking place in 56 townships across the country. And of these, 9 of the townships in Rakhine, in their entirety, cannot vote.
In April, the government enacted a presidential directive denouncing public hate speech. Despite this, the UN agency says there has been an unrelenting proliferation in Myanmar of such speech against Muslims on Facebook. The Human Rights Office criticizes continuing restrictions of the freedoms of opinion, expression, and access to information. It notes an internet shutdown remains in place in 8 townships in Rakhine and Chin states, severely limiting the ability of residents to exchange information. Shamdasani says the government has been using the worsening COVID-19 situation in the country to issue stay-at-home orders in certain areas.
And in the context of these orders as well, for example, journalists have been classed as non-essential, which means that really hampers their ability to be able to go out there and cover the elections and cover the campaigning on the hate speech and the disenfranchisement and all that we've described here. Which is all very worrying.
The UN agency is calling on Myanmar to denounce hate speech and to promote tolerance and non-discrimination in speech by public officials and candidates. It urges the government to take measures to guarantee the right of political participation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. coronavirus cases keep rising ahead of Election Day, with Midwestern states experiencing record hospitalizations. There are record numbers of new daily cases and hospitalizations across the country. In the U.K., Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered England back into national lockdown after the United Kingdom passed the milestone of 1 million COVID-19 cases and a second wave of infections threatens to overwhelm the health service. In South Korea, one of the main ways the coronavirus has spread is through cluster infections in religious communities. That's forced many religious groups to adapt to new ways of worship, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
This Presbyterian church in Seoul is one of South Korea's largest. But during the COVID-19 pandemic, most members are worshiping virtually via this Zoom broadcast held live 4 times each Sunday. It's a high-tech and safe way to worship. Reverend Oh Jung-hyun says it's a challenging dynamic, but his church is still energetic.
We have more than 100,000 viewers. Every week we are getting 85 to 90% of our usual donation.
As is the case in the rest of the world, South Korean churches have found new ways to worship during the pandemic. But South Korea's experience is unique. Health authorities have linked about a quarter of the country's total coronavirus cases to cluster infections at just 2 religious groups, including this fringe group in the 3rd largest city of Daegu. Authorities quickly imposed tight restrictions on church gatherings. It's been a struggle for smaller churches, like this independent Baptist congregation on the outskirts of Seoul.
Here, there are fewer resources to conduct online services and pay staff, says Pastor Oh Song-hyun.
Our situation is completely different. More established churches may have enough committed people, but an independent church has few members and the facilities are relatively sparse.
Two South Korean pastors told VOA they expect around 30% of smaller churches to close if the pandemic lasts much longer. And while churches like this have mostly been cooperative, others have not, including this Seoul church, whose pastor is a prominent government critic. He says religious freedom is being restricted. But law professor Lim Ji-bong says the government is within its rights to restrict religious gatherings for public health reasons.
This is a temporary restriction on the external freedom of religious assembly, and it is in the public's interest. I disagree with any notion it means the government will be able to limit this freedom forever.
It's a question of how to deal with the virus while limiting freedoms as little as possible. So far, South Korea has succeeded in containing the virus. Many churches, though, wonder how much longer the restrictions will last. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Virologists at the University of Tokyo say that while masks can offer protection from airborne COVID-19 particles, their effectiveness varies. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more on the results of this new research.
Scientists used two mannequins, one coughing out droplets containing COVID-19 and the other equipped with a mechanism which imitates human breathing, inhaling virus particles.
There is no doubt that masks reduce the amount of the virus entering into bodies. But at the same time, we should not overestimate the effectiveness of masks.
Lead researcher and professor of virology Yoshihiro Kawaoka says the level of protection from the coronavirus depends on the type of mask one wears.
We compared three different types of masks: cotton, surgical, and N95 masks, by putting a mask on a mannequin inhaling the virus. The N95 mask was the most effective one. Surgical and cotton are second and third, respectively.
Takemasa Sakaguchi says using actual coronavirus made for a better experiment.
I see the effort that they exerted to get results as close to the actual condition of inhaling the virus as possible. I believe that the result is quite similar to real life.
On the streets of the capital, Tokyo, most appear to don some form of mask, but not all have the highest level of protection.
Tokyo has around 200 new infection cases every day. So I think, at least in Tokyo, we should wear a mask.
I'm used to wearing a mask since I have hay fever. I also wear it to protect myself from flu, especially in winter. During the summer, it was a bit challenging because it was really hot, but I think there was no problem wearing a mask.
Japan has more than 98,000 coronavirus cases. At least 1,700 people have died and over 90,000 have recovered from the virus, according to government data. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Rescue workers in Turkey's third largest city, Izmir, and a nearby Greek island continue to search for survivors following a powerful earthquake Friday afternoon. There are dozens of confirmed fatalities. Buildings were violently shaken and about 20 collapsed, with many of the city's 4 million inhabitants running into the streets in panic. The nearby Greek island of Samos also was hit by the quake and tidal surges, and at least two people were reported to be killed. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan pledged all means necessary would be undertaken to assist the rescue effort. The rescue work is continuing in 17 buildings, Erdogan says, underscoring that officials at all levels took immediate action in order to rescue citizens who are under the rubble. Rescue teams are now frantically working to find survivors. The dangerous, painstaking work is being hindered by numerous aftershocks. But their efforts are being rewarded in some cases, with survivors being dug out of the rubble that was once their home. Turkey is no stranger to powerful earthquakes and has developed a great deal of expertise in rescue operations. Criticism is already growing, though, over the quality of many of the buildings. Turkish seismologist Professor Ahmet Ercan says Turkey's poor again are paying the heaviest price. The higher the poverty, the closer the earthquake is to you, he said. You will never hear of a celebrity or rich person being taken out of the rubble. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis offered his condolences to Turkish President Erdogan amid high tensions between the neighbours over disputes about territorial waters, and said it was time to stand together. Doreen Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
French authorities have announced new arrests related to an apparent Islamist terror attack at a church in Nice last week, even as they continue to investigate a separate church attack in another city shortly after. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris on the latest developments.
Sunday marks the Christian holiday of All Saints' Day. France is a traditionally Catholic country, and while many French today are not very religious, they are still reeling from back-to-back attacks targeting churches. First, a knife attack in Nice that left three people dead, and a separate shooting attack Saturday targeting a Greek Orthodox priest at his church in the city of Lyon. French media report authorities have arrested more people related to the Nice attack, which President Emmanuel Macron has described as an act of terrorism. The main suspect, Tunisian immigrant Brahim Issaoui, remains hospitalized after police shot him multiple times. Tunisian and French investigators are trying to piece together Issaoui's motivations and who might have helped him carry out the brutal knifings at Nice's Notre-Dame Basilica Thursday morning. He seems to have arrived in France only days before. Meanwhile, a suspect has been arrested in the Lyon attack, but his motive was not immediately clear. These are the latest of several attacks to hit France in recent weeks, most apparently related to the republication of cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Last month, schoolteacher Samuel Paty was decapitated by an Islamist extremist, apparently for showing the cartoons in a class on free speech. Muslims find the cartoons deeply offensive, and their republication, along with President Macron's defense of the right to publish them in the name of free expression, has led to protests and boycotts in several Muslim countries.
Et donc, je comprends et respecte qu'on puisse être choqué par ces caricatures.
In an interview with broadcaster Al Jazeera, President Macron said he understood people could be shocked by the cartoons, but that did not justify physical violence. He said he would always defend free expression in France. France has weathered multiple Islamist terrorist attacks in recent years, including the 2015 Paris attacks, along with the 2016 strike in Nice. Once again, France's national security alert is at its highest level. The country is also in lockdown in response to a separate crisis in the coronavirus pandemic. In Nice, where flowers are piled up in front of the Notre-Dame Basilica, residents told French radio they did not feel secure. The attacks have also sparked debate about France's staunch defense of secularism and just how far free speech should go. And the country's Muslim community fears it will be stigmatized. On Monday, children return to class after a two-week vacation. Schools nationwide are to hold a minute of silence to commemorate slain teacher Paty. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Cameroon observed a day of national mourning on Sunday with the Central African State flag flying at half-staff and millions of people taking to the streets, mosques, and churches to condemn barbarism and killing. People are also asking for investigations to be opened and for suspected killers and those promoting the separatist crisis that has killed 3,000 people in 4 years face justice. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Umaru Malam Jibril, a Muslim cleric, leads prayers at an ecumenical service at the multi-purpose sports complex in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Among the nearly 1,000 civilians who have come out to observe the day of national mourning is 40-year-old Catholic Stephen Ngwa. Ngwa says his younger sister's daughter was killed when gunmen attacked a school in the English-speaking southwestern town of Kumba, October 24. He says the pain inflicted on innocent citizens by the separatist conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking regions is unbearable.
This act of barbarism should not continue again. I want to use this opportunity to once more plead with boys and girls who are carrying guns in the northwest and southwest to drop their guns, for we are tired. This is not our portion.
Choir members in Yaoundé, besides praying for the killed children, asks God to bring peace back to Cameroon's English-speaking regions. The government, along with Cameroon's Ecumenical Service for Peace, mosque and Catholic, Baptist and Presbyterian churches, reported that similar services took place all over the country. The military held ceremonies in memory of the slain children. Radio and TV stations broadcast special programs in their memory. Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ondua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family, says Africa should reflect on and condemn the massacre of children at the school in Kumba. She says the killing of Cameroonian children who only wanted education is unconscionable.
Let us go back to June 16, 1976, when young Hector Peterson, who was only 12 years old, was killed in his school during the mass killing of Soweto in South Africa. Since then, this date has been established as the Day of the African Child. On October 24, 2020, it was not just one child. Where did these children go wrong? What crime did they commit?
Gunmen stormed the Mother Francisca International Bilingual Academy on October 24, killing 7 children between the ages of 9 and 12. Cameroon officials blamed Anglophone separatists for the attack. Separatists said the military killed the children to give their fighters a bad name. Cameroon has been marred by protest and violence since 2016, when English-speaking teachers and lawyers took to the streets to denounce the overbearing influence of French in the bilingual country. The central government in Yaoundé responded with a military crackdown, and separatists took weapons, claiming that they were defending English-speaking civilians. Violence in the Anglophone regions has claimed more than 3,000 lives and caused the displacement of more than 530,000 civilians, according to the United Nations. The Norwegian Refugee Council reported in June that Cameroon tops the list of the most neglected crises on the planet since 2019. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And Nikki McKibben, a singer from Texas best known for her third-place finish in the first season of American Idol, has died. McKibben's husband confirmed her death in a Facebook post, saying that she had died after suffering a brain aneurysm Wednesday and was taken off life support early Sunday. McKibben appeared on American Idol in 2002, finishing in third place in the competition. In a statement, the show called her an incredible talent and said McKibben was part of our American Idol family and will be truly missed. Nikki McKibben was 42. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.